A mum or dad with a serious mental illness, schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, say, is still a mum or dad. But too often they are prevented from parenting, often by systems and attitudes which don't have that goal in mind. And this can mean a family is broken up and a slower recovery for a parent distressed by the absence of their children. Joanne Nicholson, Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts, thinks there has to be a better way. And she joins me now. Welcome to Life Matters, Joanne.
Thank you.
And welcome also to Debbie Ross, a mother and mental health peer support worker from Townsville. Hello, Debbie.
Hello.
Joanne, there's an obvious compassion argument here that all parents should have the best possible chance of parenting as well as they can. But there's also another imperative that there are, in fact, direct health benefits, I understand.
In our work in Massachusetts, we've found that by helping parents achieve their goals for their families, in fact, they achieve their mental health goals as well.
Right. To continue parenting might not be easy, though. What are some of the day-to-day challenges that parents with a mental illness might have?
It's interesting, actually. Parents with mental illness have many of the challenges that we all have as parents. Is my school system good for my child? Do I have a good after-school program or daycare for my child? Can I access adequate health care? In addition, though, parents with mental illness have that extra layer of managing an illness, just as anyone with an illness does. The day-to-day management of a treatment regime, of self-care activities and strategies that help people sort of keep it together over the course of a day. That's a little bit more challenging for someone, particularly with a serious mental illness.
Right. Okay. Well, Debbie, if I could bring you in here, what was your situation when you first became ill?
Well, I became ill 12 years ago, and I had three children, and they were only young then, and I was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Unfortunately, my marriage broke down, and I had to spend a period of 12 months in an extended treatment facility. So I was separated from my children for during that 12 months.
Was that the hardest thing?
It was. It was very hard for me. Even though they came to visit, you know, a couple of times a week, it wasn't the same as being a full-time parent. And I was having anxiety about not being with my children.
Mm. Do you think, looking back, that you could have been with them in that time? That you could have looked after them properly?
For the first couple of months, I couldn't have. But then after that, I think I was quite well enough to take control of their day-to-day situation. But it was taken off me. It was more or less said that it would be too stressful for me. They weren't considering me as a whole person, as a mother. It was more or less, well, she's got schizophrenia and the stress might be too much.
Right. So what helped you most in terms of family connection?
I think it was... like my ex-husband, he was very proactive in the children becoming a part of my life again. And I had support from a agency called CASPERS, which is a support group for children whose parents have a mental illness. So the children understood what was happening to mum, and they had another outlet to talk with as well. And I think it came down to having a really good support worker who seen that what I wanted was to become a full-time parent again.
Mm. Well, we'll come back to you and your story in a few minutes, but we spoke earlier to Wayne from South Australia, and when he was diagnosed with bipolar affective disorder in 1995, his daughter was 13 and his son 11, but he reckons he was probably ill for 5 years before that.
We were living in the city. We had a 7-day deli in Adelaide, and so, you know, I was working extremely long hours. I was working, you know, until 10 o'clock in the evening and going without sleep for days on end. This was just before the first Gulf War, and so my paranoia started developing around, you know, there being, you know, a world war, and so I sold my business and took my family to what I considered to be, you know, a safe place in the country, which on reflection indicates, in my view, the early onset of my illness.
Right, so you were delusional about safety?
Yes,
Right. And how did it start to manifest after that?
After that, my fears for my children's safety were exaggerated by the schoolyard shootings in America, that I had false fixed beliefs that could happen to my children. And back then, I wanted my children to have mobile phones, and for, you know, 9-year-olds to have mobile phones back then was enough to have anyone certified. I know that would not be the case today, but back then, you know, it was just such a radical thing, and, you know, I argued senselessly with my wife over that issue.
And
my wife went on to have a car accident, and I thought my thoughts had caused that car accident, and some of my hallucinations then, I was wheeling the clothes basket out to the clothesline, and I thought I could, you know, it was my wife in the wheelchair, I thought, at that time. And I was having wheelchair handling lessons. I was working with the frail aged and people with disabilities. And so it was a mixture of these thoughts becoming distorted.
So that sounds like you were becoming increasingly distressed.
Yes, yes, yes. I was also laid off my work. There was a tree that had been poisoned, and I took one of my clients to hug the tree, and that went down not too well. And so I was, dismissed from my work, you know, as a result of that. But my behaviour, you know, I mean, I was, you know, my hair and my clothing, you know, in a small country town where, you know, people are pretty country folk,
yep.
And I was from the city. I was, you know, pretty well ostracised in the community, which no doubt led to, you know, depression, etc.
So what were your kids witnessing or experiencing because of all this?
Yes, well, they would be, you know, seeing me, you know, up all night and sleeping during the day. They would see their mother working and me not working. They would be, you know, listening to my, you know, harebrained ideas, and they would be, you know, witnessing my verbiosity. My, you know, I would be speaking incessantly. I would be having, you know, delusions of grandeur. I would, you know, be interrupting their television watching time or their study time, you know, to the extent that they would isolate in their rooms. My daughter, you know, threw herself into her studies and, you know, went on to be an A-grade student. My son became pretty well addicted to gaming on the internet, and so, you know, they both isolated, really.
And do you think they were concerned or even scared?
My son was definitely scared. My son, you know, had a lot of fear. I remember one instance. I had my hair dyed red. I have, you know, like browny, mousy brown hair, and I had it, you know, dyed reddy, orangey colour. And I remember coming home, and, you know, my son was just, you know, his eyes popped out of his head. He was, you know, really, you know, fearful. I can still remember this now.
And
my daughter seemed to, and in retrospect, and to this day, my daughter. I'm estranged from my son, and I'm divorced. But my daughter has been, you know, extremely supportive over the, you know, the last, especially the last 10 years, I suppose. But maybe the first 5 years, you know, when I was, you know, I was housebound, bedbound, and you know, they were finishing their education. And, you know, as their knowledge increased, I suppose it drove my son away with the fears that he may end up with a mental illness. But my daughter's acknowledgement and understanding, you know, of her mood swings and normalities of life, she has been a great support to me. And now I'm able to support her, as she has two small children, and so I have two grandchildren, and things are a lot, lot better.
That's quite a story, and we'll hear a bit more from Wayne later on about the sorts of support that he got. On Life Matters today, we are talking about this idea, which you might think is an unusual one, and that is parenting with a mental illness. With me are Debbie Ross, who's a mother and mental health peer support worker, and also Joanne Nicholson. She's Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts, and she's been pioneering some work over there and is here in Australia to talk about it. Joanne, just thinking from the kids' perspective, how do you evaluate when it's in their interest and when it's not? This is a crucial question, it seems to me, for their parent to be around.
I think that each family situation is unique and really needs to be examined very carefully. I think that families often have many resources and supports they can bring to the table to use, to put into play on behalf of children who are living with a parent with mental illness. I think what happens is that people wrongly assume in these situations that it's a no-go, that a parent with mental illness is just not capable ever of parenting, and that's just not true. I think among people with schizophrenia, among people with bipolar disorder, frankly, among parents in general, there's a real range of capacities and abilities to function.
But I suppose just as there are some parents who don't have a mental illness, who it might not be in the children's best interest for them to be around, that
right.
Surely must happen for parents with a mental illness as well.
Right. And in situations, of course, where children are in danger or at risk, then alternative arrangements really need to be made. But again, I think, as Debbie has pointed out, oftentimes these decisions are made without really considering the needs or interests or goals of the individual who's living with serious mental illness.
We just heard from Wayne, and though some of Wayne's family are estranged, the ongoing relationship with his daughter and her children must mm-hmm. do a lot for his well-being.
Yes. It sounds from his telling that that's exactly true.
Debbie, can I ask you, what do you think about the importance of those ongoing relationships?
The ongoing relationships are very important to us. It's important that we have the opportunity to keep those relationships going at all times, even though there may be periods when we're unwell. For example, like if I went into a psychosis, my children would have the knowledge that Mum is unwell at the moment and that she will become well again, and that they go and stay with another relative during that time. But it's very important for us to maintain the hope. I think hope is the big word there, that we can remain on our road to recovery and maintain those relationships.
Is it possible sometimes, do you think, that children actually not exactly become responsible for care, but can be helpful in knowing when somebody who is ill may be starting to become more ill?
Definitely. They're with us day to day, and they can pick up a lot on the early warning signs, early warning signals, and a lot of them are the forgotten carers. They're hidden in society, but they do take on that role of realising that something's not quite right with Mum or Dad.
And actually knowing that when Mum or Dad does this, that actually it might be time to try and suggest, sitting down and calming down or something like that?
Yeah. My boys have an action plan which is stuck on their wardrobe, and they know what to do. So if Mum starts to be, say that there's voices or something, they know what steps to actually take to contact the community mental health, or whether it be my support worker, or, they do have permission to ring 000 as well, which I think is important, because some children think, oh, no, I better not ring 000, but they know that it's on their plan, so they're given the ability to ring all those numbers.
It legitimises it, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
Well, let's move now to the sort of help that works. And here's Wayne again. He was relatively lucky in the professional support he got.
We had incredibly good individual supports. I can start with my children. They had access to what a CAMS is, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services. So my children, and the issue for them was these meetings would be, say, once a month, but they would be with different people over a 3 or 6 month period, and my children complained about having to tell their story to different people. But they had that opportunity to speak to professionals and were given literature on, you know, mental illness. They were given, you know, at that time, appropriate children's type books. We had a mental health nurse that would come to our house, and in my view, the mental health nurse visited and spoke with my wife far more than me. And our GP would see my wife and I once a fortnight as like a family, a couple therapy type thing. And my psychiatrist would only see me. In retrospect, if there had been, you know, multidisciplinary teamwork where we were all seen, myself, my wife, and the children, by I don't know what profession, I don't know whether that, you know, would.
So you were getting a fairly impressive lineup of professionals working with you and your family, but there were flaws in the support.
Well, only in retrospect, and I've never been critical of it, of the, you know, the supports that we had.
Well, that was Wayne. And if I could come back to you, Joanne Nicholson, from the University of Massachusetts. Wayne there was talking about wishing there had been a multidisciplinary team working with the whole family. It sounds like a good idea. Does such a thing exist?
It's a terrific idea. What Wayne is talking about is what we've been talking about all week as a whole of family approach to mental health and mental illness treatment. I've been traveling across Australia as a guest of the Mental Illness Fellowship of Australia, meeting with people in Sydney, Canberra, Melbourne, Adelaide, and Perth who are part of the member organizations in every state and territory, and people are focused on and talking about a whole-of-family approach, a coordinated approach that we've tried out in the U.S. and tested with quite favorable results that provides information, psychoeducation, supports and resources to all family members in a coordinated package so that the kinds of supports that benefited Debbie, the kinds of supports that benefited Wayne, could be coordinated and targeted to each family member, whether that family member is a child or the adult with mental illness or a grandparent or other family member, partner, who might be wanting to provide support but not knowing exactly what to do. This whole of family approach, I think, is a very a good idea.
Yeah, well, it occurs to me, particularly for children, because if children don't understand what is going on, and why mum or dad is behaving in this way or has to be separated from them, then children are going to, with that uncanny ability children have, imagine the worst and be fearful.
Exactly. And I think partners, grandparents, other family members, I think Debbie was quite fortunate to have an ex-partner who was thoughtful and sensitive about her wish to continue parenting her children. Those people need information, need accurate psychoeducation and supports as well.
Well, Debbie, if I could come back to you, what sort of supports have you had and which worked best for you?
I think the best kind of support I've had is through my case managers in the community, where they come and visit you on a regular basis and just check that, see things are going okay. They're not so much based on the medical model, but more of the, As Joanne was talking about, the whole person, the whole family model. That's the best support that I've received in the community. But there's been personal helpers and mentors scheme, which is a national initiative, and they've come on board. And since they've been on board, my kids and I have been able to spend more quality time, and they helped me gain full custody of one of my sons. And that was only through working closely together and trying to put our view across, to advocate my view that I was fine to parent full-time instead of part-time, and that the stresses, you know, that I could cope with the stresses of day-to-day parenting. So it was a big step for the kids as well. Like, they wanted to be with mum full-time, but they were being held back.
Yes.
You know, so it was a big stress on them.
Joanne, can I come back to you here? I mean, Debbie's a mum, obviously. Wayne, who's a dad, mentioned actually separately to us that there are far too many men in single men's accommodation, many of them with families somewhere. Do you think support for fathers is sometimes overlooked?
Absolutely. I think that, well, I know that from our data, men with mental illness are just as likely to be parents as men, well, more likely than men without mental illness. We have a lot of fathers out there who may well be disenfranchised from their families, who would benefit from the kinds of supports that Debbie and Wayne have talked about to reconnect with their children, to create opportunities for positive interactions with children. I think many men would really be committed to that.
Indeed. That is where we'll wrap this up. But thank you both of you for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
Professor Joanne Nicholson from the University of Massachusetts Medical School was brought to Australia by the Mental Illness Fellowship of Australia. She's been giving talks and meeting health policymakers around the country. Debbie Ross from Townsville is a parent and mental health peer support worker. And Wayne, whom you heard from as well, is both of those things also. He's from regional South Australia. We'd like to hear from you on this. Use the story-based commenting on the Life Matters website, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Just click on the story. It gives you a chance to comment. And you can also send us an email from the same place. And if you're on Facebook, we're very easy to find. Give us a ring also, 02833 1430. Still to come today, meet the listener and his relationship with technology. But next, we meet a trailblazer in more ways than one.